From the Sky News Centre at 5, a morbidly obese teenager who weighs over 60 stone is in a stable condition after emergency services had to knock down parts of her home to get her to hospital. Over 40 rescue workers battled to get Georgia Davis out of her home in Aberdare. Nutritionist Bridget Benlam says obesity rates in teenagers have more than doubled in the last 30 years.
That's not because children have become any more greedy or any more lazy than they were 30 years ago. It's because our environment is completely changed, and it's much more difficult to be physically active than it was previously, and there's a much bigger variety of energy-dense foods that are available at very low cost.
Jeremy Hunt's former special advisor says he was told to resign. Adam Smith's been giving evidence at the Leveson inquiry into press standards and says the culture secretary told him, "Everyone thinks you need to go." Libya's new prime minister has visited the place where PC Yvonne Fletcher was shot dead in 1984. The shots were fired from inside the Libyan embassy, but no one has ever been charged over her murder. Football England manager Roy Hodgson says it's sad that families of some of his players won't be travelling to Euro 2012 because of fears of racism. Theo Walcott's relatives won't go to Ukraine, and it's a similar situation for the families of Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain and Julian Lescott. Hodgson hopes no racist incidents occur during the games.
We can only have faith in UEFA that they're aware of these problems which exist, in particular in the Ukraine. And we can only hope that they solve the problems, because there's literally nothing we can do. But I do think it is sad if some of the families of the players are deciding not to go as a result of it.
And in showbiz, Hollywood star Keira Knightley is to marry her rock star boyfriend James Wrighton from the Claxons. The couple have become engaged after dating since early last year. The stars are said to have been introduced by their friend Alexa Chung. That's the latest. I'm Rachel Jewell.
Back to reality. BCFM is the award-winning community radio station for Bristol, and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice. BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Hello, Bristol. Welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping us review this week's news is Green Party councillor for the Ashley Ward, Gus Hoyt. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, who owns Britain? You might be surprised to hear our big landowning families have hardly changed since the 17th century Civil War. That's the feudal lords, and they're still alive and well and doing very nicely, thank you. Who Owns Britain is the title of a book by the South West-based journalist Kevin Carhill, and he'll be joining us to explain why owning a semi-detached house, just enough to stop you going mad with claustrophobia, is the most we can look forward to, while the feudal landlords still have hundreds of thousands of acres they will never see, let alone walk on. And we also look at, if you add up the cost of materials and labour to build a home, why the true cost of housing should be around about £6 a week. Another racket. So why is it so much more? Also, a nuclear clash could starve the world. That's the message in a report released at the Nobel Peace Laureate Summit in Chicago, just before the NATO summit last weekend. And it's entitled Nuclear Famine, A Billion People at Risk. And the study shows that even a limited nuclear war involving less than half of 1% of the world's nuclear arsenals would cause climate disruption that could set off a global famine. That's in the second hour after the news at 6. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, last week I was complaining about the lack of summer. Someone was listening, and it's arrived. So anyway, tonight, lows of 13 Celsius and dry this weekend. Highs up over 21 Celsius, sunny on Saturday, but a little cloudier on Sunday. Next week, highs of 20 Celsius, some showers this week, but also plenty of sunshine, cooling down as the week progresses. Next weekend, that's the 2nd and 3rd of June, highs of 20, sunshine and some showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, joining us for this week's news review is Green Party councillor for Ashley Ward, Gus Hoyt. Hi, Gus. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, Tony. Thanks for coming.
Now, your party is standing a candidate as mayor. First of all, did you agree with the whole mayor thing in the first place?
Absolutely not, no. It leads to a great centralisation of power, if nothing else. It will also lead to greater control from London of Bristol, though it's dressed up as completely the opposite, of course.
But the thing is, people are fed up with the tremendous amount of bureaucracy, and they think that one person is going to be able to cut through that bureaucracy.
Well, that's it. Everyone thinks in this day and age that, you know, one person can sort everything out. We do live in the age of personality, unfortunately, and if anything, I think it could be quite catastrophic for Bristol.
Well, the Evening Post was actually fair play to them, and I think it even was called the Evening Post back in those days. It was saying a dictatorship. Would you take it that far?
I wouldn't go as far as say dictatorships. They will actually be elected, but you know, as far as our electoral system goes in this country, I mean, you look at Parliament, and realistically, we've got an elected tyranny. If you look at the dictionary definition there, okay. So broadly speaking, yes.
Okay, so tell us about the Green Party's candidate then.
Well, we haven't yet chosen one. We've just put a shout out to all members. What we will be doing, though, is leading through policies, not personality. And we're very busy writing our manifesto as I speak. And the first point of that will be devolving greater powers and spending abilities to local communities.
Okay. Also, the Green Party is well known for its ideas on the environment. Tell us about how you think the waste contract's been going here in Bristol, because this is one thing that everybody really comes across in one way or another, whether it's litter blowing around in their street, piles of rubbish left on a wall somewhere, maybe down the street, and also, of course, the bin collections.
Yeah, well, you've pretty much summed it all up there. We've had numerous complaints, you know, on a daily basis. We just had a meeting the other day, actually, where we started up a Montpellier's Residents Association. And the second point on the agenda there is, what can we do about our streets? Because it just looks like someone has come along and literally emptied a whole bin onto our streets, which then, yeah, just gets blown around everywhere. It's great that we are now recycling plastic and Tetra Paks, but it's not enough when, you know, litter is literally covering our pavements, and Lower Montpellier and St Paul's, especially in my ward, are in an absolutely shocking state.
Well, May Gurney have taken over the contract famously last year. How are they doing?
Well, this is the whole problem with privatisation, really. I mean, we have no direct accountability anymore. We can introduce fines later on when they're not doing the job very well, but this is what, over 6 months later, and they're still not really cutting the mustard.
Okay, we're also joined by Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Martin, we've had another sort of fraught week of so-called Euro crisis. There's a kind of lack of decision again over whether Greece is really going to leave. Lots of economists say it will, and I think you were suggesting it may well do. But another fudge, essentially. Would you agree?
Well, they're trying to find another fudge, but it may be a fudge too far. And in actual fact, what we're going to see is a banking collapse because they can't come to agreement. People think this is about the euro, or they think it's about Greece. It's actually about the banking system. And if they don't find a fudge, for example, agree to print euro bonds so that there can be some quantitative easing by the European Central Bank, which is what the Americans and the British want, and all the other Europeans and the Germans don't want it, if they can't find that fudge, and I don't think they can, then it's bank crash time.
Is there actually really any reason why they shouldn't be printing money? I mean, we've done quantitative easing in this country.
Well, I mean, that's what the
over the last three or four
that's
years.
What the American and British view is. Well, we've, you know, we don't care. We print money hand over fist. Why can't you? But the Germans have got historical reasons for resisting the idea. They are seen to be irrational by others, saying, look, it doesn't do you any harm. One smoke of a crack pipe won't addict you. Just join the party. But the Germans are going, nope. We don't want to join your
party. So are they right to be doing that from their own point of view?
From their own point of view, they are, although, of course, but they're also very self-righteous. They don't realise that being in the euro has been very good for Germany. If they'd been on the Deutschmark all these years, their exports wouldn't look nearly as good as they do.
Can you explain why is that?
What you need if you want to export is a low exchange rate compared to others. It sounds counterintuitive, like a lot of economics does to people who are not educated in it, but actually you want to have a low exchange rate, not a high exchange rate. Yeah, if you've got a high exchange rate, that's good for people who are wealthy, and it's good for people who are going on holiday. But if you're manufacturing things to sell abroad, you want a low pound or a low Deutschmark or a low euro or a low dollar or a low yuan or whatever it may be. And basically what we had in the 30s was competitive devaluation because governments set their own rates in those days, and their currency was set by the government, so everybody started pegging their currencies down. Because everybody can't peg their currencies down against everybody else. It's not it's not logically possible.
But isn't it sort of just common sense from the Germans to say, look, why should we sacrifice our economy for all you others?
No,
like
what
Greece?
They don't realise is that by doing that, they will sacrifice their economy, because if Greece goes out of the euro and defaults on its debts, there will be a chain of default running back into the derivatives market, which will smash the German banks. And then the German banks will withdraw funding for German industry, and everybody in Germany will be out of work. But they think that they're somehow going to be all right. It's the I'm all right, Jack, pull up the ladder attitude. And of course, in Greece, people are saying, well, hang on a minute, you haven't paid us a penny of compensation for what you did to us in World War II. And they turn around to the British and the Americans, who forced a military government on them in 1972, and say, hang on a minute, you haven't paid us a penny of compensation for what you did to us in 1967 when the colonels took power. And of course, Germany was let off all its debts in 1952 because we needed them to fight the Russians communists. And of course, they've forgotten all that, and now everybody must pay what they owe. We all know that. Everybody has to pay what they owe. Right, Germany. So, it's like, let's put a list of what you owe us. World War One, World War Two.
Okay.
Plus, you owe us quite a bit, don't you?
So,
have you ever paid any compensation?
Before,
no, only to Israel.
Okay, well, before we get Gus's views on the financial situation, let's have a listen to Wednesday evening and this Euro meeting, because David Cameron and Nick Clegg both had some comments to make about what they thought that the Euro leaders should do.
What happens in the Eurozone affects our country. And of course, what we need is a decisive plan for Greece, and we need decisive plans to help get the European economies moving. But if we're not going to keep coming back and back to meetings like this, we also need to deal with some of the longer-term issues at the heart of running a successful single currency, having a bank that gets behind that single currency, having coherent long-term plans to make sure that single currency is coherent.
The Deputy Prime Minister, Nick Clegg, is warning that a Greek withdrawal from the euro would cause unpredictable, irrevocable damage to the single currency. In a speech in Berlin, he will say that no rational person should advocate Greece's withdrawal from the euro. Mr. Clegg will call for new fiscal instruments to deal with debt problems and criticise what he calls fatalism, that the problems facing the eurozone cannot be fixed.
That was an extract from the Midnight News on Wednesday night. Gus, that was the Liberal Democrat leader saying that no rational person could say that Greece should come out of the euro. What are your thoughts about that comment particularly?
I'd actually agree more with what Martin was saying, and that basically it's time for us to basically have a jubilee and start cancelling debts. Africa has been just absolutely crippled for such a long time. Deliberately because of our economic system, and now this has spread to Europe. What we need to realise is that the economic system we're using and the form of capitalism we're using is fundamentally flawed. And it's, you know, I think it was Einstein that said, you know, a fool is the person that uses using one method and then repeats it again. We'll just get the same effects. I mean, you know, we need to move on.
Martin, David Cameron calling for a decisive plan, although he's not actually putting much detail on what that should be.
Yes, it's a bit like Captain Mannering demanding a decisive plan, isn't it? What is the decisive plan? I'll get back to you on that one. Now, in actual fact, the substance of Cameron's position, as I understand it, is that he generally supports the austerity policies pursued by Germany. I mean, he could hardly do it otherwise, since he's imposed similar stuff on us. But he does support the American call and the call of the French and others for euro bonds to be floated, which in other words means that the ECB should be allowed to do quantitative easing like the Bank of England and the Fed.
Printing money, basically.
But as Angela Merkel quite rightly points out, that's against existing EU treaties. There is other people saying, yes, but if we don't do that, the banks are going to collapse. And I think the Germans haven't quite followed through the logic of their own position, which is if they don't go along with what everybody else is saying, i.e. print some money, then the banks will collapse. And I think that is going to happen sooner or later anyway. And the German position, they're not going to budge, because Angela Merkel is not just being awkward. She can see the opinion polls in Germany, and the Germans public just haven't been educated about why they should bail everybody else out, because they think that's, you know, there's an illusion in Germany that they work harder than people in Greece, although in actual fact people in Greece in work longer hours than people in Germany. People in Germany have long holidays and they stay in university until they're 28, and in actual fact they have quite a cushy time, but they think they work hard. What they've got is a well-organised setup, which of course is what we should have if we were more organised. But the fact of the matter is, I think we're coming to the end game now, and there is going to be a Greek default. There is going to be a disorderly exit from the euro, and at that point it will all lead back into the city of London, and there will be an explosion which will blow away. We will be at ground zero here in Britain. It will blow away the economy, and it will blow away the coalition government.
Now, we had your former colleague Laszlo Andor on here a couple of months ago, actually, and he was saying, look, and he's basically a civil servant, isn't he, in the EU. Very high level, really. He's saying that the politicians simply aren't listening to what the experts are telling them in Europe.
Well, they're unwilling to. The politicians don't answer to the experts. They answer to their funders, which is the bankers, who are the problem. And that's who do you think funds the Conservative Party? It's all these hedge fund people and bankers. And they don't want to consider the real solution, which is to let their institutions go down like a Welsh coal mine. Filled with water. We're not going to waste any more time and money on you. You've all got to go. And that they can't accept that. And they're not even talking in those terms. When we bailed the banks out in 2008, the politicians should have asserted the people's will over the banking sector. They didn't do that because A, they were taken by surprise, and B, they're too far in the pocket of the bankers. Now, of course, the bankers have carried on doing what they've been doing for 4 years and pushed everything right to the extreme. And in the end, the market does work. The market solution for all this debt, as coming back to what you were saying about a Jubilee, the market solution is a crash. That's what markets do when they're overbought.
But this isn't the diamond Jubilee you're talking about here, is it?
No, well, what should be happening, as Gus was suggesting, is in an orderly fashion, debts should be forgiven. But what will happen, as Keynes pointed out in the 30s, it's a logical point, it's not a political point, debts that can't be paid won't be paid. And you can beat Greece as much as you like, but the donkey is dead and it's not going to get up.
You're
not going to get your money back. Whoever has lent money to Greece has lost it. And they're going to have to take the loss. But that means, of course, they then go back to the government to say, oh, we lent loads of money to Greece and we're now making a loss. Please, Mr. Cameron and Mr. Osborne, will you bail us out? And, of course, they probably will be bailed out if there's money there to bail them out with. But, of course, that game is running out. There is no money to bail them out with. And at that point, you know, you reach... does not compute time to explode, you know, the computer just blows up.
Okay, finally though, Martin, if you were banging heads together amongst these political leaders, what kind of bit of paper would you be telling them to sign?
They need to recognise that the banking sector is basically not just illiquid but insolvent. And that means basically we've got to wind up the private banks in an orderly fashion. A bankruptcy procedure needs to be brought through for it. So we go through the whole books and a lot of the debts are written off. Lots of wealthy people who lent their money in the banks and lent their money to the banks have got to lose that money. A lot of people have got to be sent to prison, because when we can find that people have actually deliberately engaged in criminal activity, as we may be discovering in News International.
Are you talking about accounting and this kind of
accounting
and so on.
You don't just say, oh, slap on the wrist. You say, right, got you. We're going to take all your assets and all this whining. If you raise taxes on us, we're going to go off to the Cayman Islands. No, you won't, because you're going to be in Wandsworth prison and we're taking all your assets. And that's if the most of that we can get through, the less taxes we will have to raise on everybody else. So it's in everybody's interest to to jail as many bankers as possible, because we can seize all their assets, as we do with drug dealers. And all that money then pays for our nursery schools. It's easy, isn't it?
OK, Gus, finally, what is the Green Party's policy on dealing with this kind of austerity? Because there's a lot of basic facilities out there being provided, some of the most vulnerable in society are now being closed down. What would the Green Party be doing?
Well, basically, the whole economic focus at the moment is going in the wrong direction. And we're spending it on, and by we, I mean the country, we're spending it on things we shouldn't be. We're investing, you know, pouring money away down to just bottomless wells, as sort of Martin was alluded to then. And we need to really focus on what we want in society, which is basically the people. You know, we need to stop focusing on short-term profit and percentages, and just focus on what really matters, and that's, you know, each and every one of us around here. We need to invest in schools, community centres, and the bloody NHS.
Okay, Martin, Argentina and Iceland, have we got lessons to learn from these places?
Well, Iceland, as a small country, managed to get away from this all of this, and they've refused to pay a penny. They've put their bankers and their politicians in jail. And they're being sued by the British and the Dutch, because, of course, the British and the Dutch had to pick up the British taxpayers who had their money in those banks. Now, of course, if you were following the free market policy, people put their money in the Icelandic banks, including the local authorities, at a higher interest rate, which means a higher risk. So if the Icelanders refuse to pay, you just say, right, well, you've got to take the hit. But, of course, the British government was not really prepared to have its citizens lose their money, so it bailed them out and then went back to the Icelanders and said, will you pay us? And the Icelanders just said no, so that just goes on Britain's debt. That just adds to Britain's problems. The Argentinians a few years ago are doing pretty much what the Greeks are doing now, saying, look, we are going to go through the floor here. Now, you either come to an agreement with us about what we're prepared to pay, and we are prepared to pay something, otherwise we're not going to pay anything, and that will bring down your banking system. And Greece, even as a small country, 2% of EU GDP, never mind international GDP, Argentina was slightly more important, even one small country like that refusing to pay will bring down the banking system. That's how vulnerable it is.
It sounds like almost like a game of chicken.
It is a game of chicken now. The Greeks, it looks like the Alex Tsipras's party are going to get 30% plus of the vote in July the 7th. 17th rather, and in the bizarre system
this is the new election. Do you think that's going to actually help solve things?
Well, no, but in the bizarre system they have in Greece, if you become the first party, it's a proportional system, but if you're the first party you get 50 extra seats. The idea is that it gives a solid push to whoever wins. So if Tsipras's party get 30% of the vote and 50 extra seats, they will be the government, and they're going to turn around and say they don't want to leave the euro and they don't want to repudiate their debts. They want a better deal, and they're saying, you give us a better deal or we are just going to walk away. And of course they are entitled to do that, to just walk away from their debt, walk away from everything. And of course that will be tough for them, but of course what they will do is set up a chain reaction which will make it tough for everybody else. And the Greeks have reached the point, I think, where they can't see any alternative. And they don't want to crash the international system, but if they have to in order to assert their sovereignty, then they will. And if people think they're bluffing, they are wrong. They need to know a bit about Greek history.
Okay, another bit of news this week. Shoppers need to be wary over special offers in supermarkets. And this particular version of this story is from myfinances.co.uk. There are apparently lots of strategies being used by supermarkets in order to con us into thinking they've got special offers. Promotional products. Products, for example, have been on offer for far longer than they were ever at the original price. Which magazine highlighted also how Tesco sold Beck's beer for $190 days at the discount price compared to only 70 days at the normal price. What can we do, Gus, about supermarkets who are conning us in this way? Because essentially that's exactly what they're doing. They've got some sort of thing on the shelf, they're saying this is on some special offer, but actually to some extent, some of these offers, you're paying almost twice as much as a normal price.
Yeah, I think what we need is very strict guidelines and huge fines, on-the-spot fines for things like this. Basically, it's breaking all advertising rules. Very often what they'll do as well is they'll slap a great big sticker on that says only a pound, whereas normally they sell it for 99p. But because it's got that big red star on it, everyone thinks they're getting a blinding deal. I mean, they're just ripping off people in times where we can't be doing this.
Now, another ruse that all the supermarkets follow is to increase the original price just before an item is put on offer, making the discount appear more attractive. Martin?
Well, I mean, the other thing we need to do, apart from, as you say, on-the-spot fines for these kind of trading standards violations, if you like, is basically destroy the power of supermarkets by creating local networks for retail, a bit like Stapleton Road or whatever, where you've got lots of little shops where the prices genuinely are good and it really is local.
But it's very, very difficult for these little shops to compete with the supermarkets, Martin. If you go around all over this country, you'll see high streets with empty shops where shops have, small businesses have collapsed trying to compete with the supermarkets.
Indeed, because the supermarkets have basically rigged the system in their favour. They lobbied, for example, to get rid of resale price maintenance years ago, and that means, of course, that they can sell stuff at a loss. Now, how can a small retailer compete with that? So they'll sell stuff at a loss to get people in the store, and then they'll claw it all back by selling them other stuff overpriced. And, of course, what they're actually doing is destroying the competition. And this is the whole argument we had this time last year about Tesco's opening up in Stokes Croft.
Talking of Tesco's, Gus, the Tesco spokesman said, "We change millions of price labels in store and online each week, and we do sometimes make mistakes, for which we apologise."
Well, I think you probably know my opinions of Tesco's, and I wouldn't trust that spokesperson as far as I could throw them.
Okay, free banking row is hotting up. That's our next story, and that's in yesterday's Guardian. A debate over the merits of free banking is raging after top banking regulator Andrew Bailey faced criticism after appearing to call for an end to non-fee paying current accounts to prevent the mis-selling of financial products. Richard Lloyd, executive director of consumer body Which, which said it was a myth that banking was free. Customers pay over $9 billion a year in fees and lost interest on their current accounts. The idea that if banks charged more, they would stop trying to missell other financial products is completely unfounded, he said. Martin, Britain apparently is one of the only countries in the world where it's quite easy to get a current account which is free of all charges. Do you think that the banks are right to now come forward and say, well, no, bank accounts are going to be free? And this is the regulator speaking here.
I think the fact is there's no free lunch, and of course they do rake it back because they charge, as soon as you go into overdraft, they charge you enormous amounts of money, and they get it back off, especially off poor people who have overdrafts, people like me. Of course, wealthy people get very good deals, and they certainly do get free banking. I mean, basically, what's happening is that the banks, although they've been bailed out by the taxpayer, are building up their reserves at the expense of their customers. And they're not lending anything into the economy. And there's good reasons for that, because I wouldn't lend anybody any money at this moment when there's about to be a banking collapse. You'd be a fool if you did. So, that you know, beating them up about that is misguided. I mean, frankly, we need banking to be run as a public utility. And it needs to be properly, not just regulated, but basically run by the public, for the public.
Isn't one of the problems, Martin, that the Financial Conduct Authority and the FSA are both, this is the regulatory bodies, are both actually funded by the banks?
Well, yes. I mean, that just says it all, doesn't it? Self-regulation, we all know how well that works. That is exactly right. They're in a position, of course, that they've become a kind of vested interest at the heart of our society, which is virtually impossible to challenge, because if you try to imagine a different kind of way of doing it, it's very difficult to get there from where we are now. We've bailed them out, and therefore we can't afford to let them fail. But when they do fail, as I say they will, and I think they will, then they've failed. And at that point, we really can start afresh. It'll be chaotic, it'll be horrific, but at least the banks will be gone.
Gus, would you mind paying a few pounds a month for charges just to have a bank account, even if you're in credit?
Well, like Martin, unfortunately, I'm on a very low wage. Being a counsellor doesn't pay very much in the slightest. And I frequently find myself going overdrawn, and that is where they make their money. I don't think, you know, whether they charge us a pound here, a pound there, it would just be a more honest way of saying it, really. Yeah. It's kind of almost like the lottery. You know, it's always the poor people that pay. The grasp that the banks do have over us, and the way that they dictate just the language of our society, is exactly the same way that that supermarkets do our food economy. And a radical shake-up is needed.
I must say, I do find it a little bit peculiar that banks can create money out of nowhere, lend it out at interest, and then still not make money. Martin, why is that?
Well, they do make money for the insiders, that's to say the shareholders.
But what they're saying here is that they can't actually afford to give us free bank accounts because they're not making enough money, actually, what they're doing.
They're not making enough money for the profits and the bonuses. Don't forget they're all in competition with each other, so they all have to make enormous amounts of profit, otherwise the big players will move to other pastures. So, you know, basically, they're like a feudal aristocracy that have to be paid off before anything else can be done. And we're going to be talking about the old-fashioned feudal aristocracy of land in the second part, but we've got an aristocracy of money now, and before anybody can do anything, they have to be paid off.
But aren't they being paid off already, even though they're failing?
Yes, that's right. They are, and they demand more. And nevertheless, they're not doing anything to reboot the economy, because frankly, they can't. They're driven by their own self-interest. Banks are not charities. They're not there to help us. They're there to make money off us.
Okay. Yes, Gus?
Yeah, and I think the best thing we can do really is invest our money in local credit unions, which actually do invest small loans to local people, and that does make a difference. The money stays in the community, and it benefits everyone.
So what's the difference between a bank?
Out of the big banks, out of Barclays, out of Lloyds, out of HSBC, and join local credit unions.
What's the advantage of that then? I mean, you're saying it's that the money stays locally, but I mean, can you have a debit card, a credit card, these kind of things with a credit union?
Unfortunately, on most of them, no, you can't at the moment. You do have to rely on the mega banks for those.
Because I mean, most of us like to do this sort of thing. I mean, personally, I would never touch online banking, but to be able at least to go to a cash point and get your money out.
Actually, here in Bristol, the Bristol Pound's about to be launched, and that does have an electronic means of transaction. All you need is a mobile phone, and most people do have those. So, yeah, join the Bristol Pound and local credit unions.
Well, it sounds like Bristol may be a little bit ahead of the curve on this one before Martin's banks collapse. At least we've got our own currency.
Yeah, well, I'm afraid what happens with little credit unions in a banking collapse is they're swept away like rowing boats when the Titanic goes down. What we need is an overall change of the system. The system as a whole should be solid and stable. It should be about taking in the deposits from people with money and lending to those without, on an agreed basis, with an agreed level of leverage. And all of the derivatives markets should be just blown up or burned, as Myron Scholes, who invented them all, said a few years ago.
OK, we're going to be going over to Westminster to Prime Minister's questions to hear our local MP, Stephen Williams, after some music.
I can't stand what's going on. It's a criminal operation.
Wall Street is hijacked Washington.
It's called fascism. The merger of state and corporate powers. The money changers and bankers have taken over.
Look at the people who are in charge of the video shop. And the Goldman Sachs bag with Merrill Lynch mob. The
JPMorgan
Chase crew.
It's theft. It's theft in front of everyone's eyes. It's not only happening here, it's happening all over the world. I mean, this is very simple. It's not complex. There's no democracy in the United States. That's only for little kids.
And anybody that supports this criminal operation, that doesn't talk out against this criminal operation, to me, is an accessory to the crime. Everybody that supports the bombings,
have been robbing the people in broad daylight.
So it's one big crime syndicate.
The International Mafia Federation. It's one club. It's the mafia, the financial mafia. These are money junkies. They got a bad habit. They're gamblers.
Nothing's going to change this country. Not until we have a direct democracy system where the people vote on
their traditions. They let them get away with it, and I'll tell you why. Because people have lost their courage, their dignity, their respect, their integrity, and their passion, and they put up with a load of cheap baloney.
Nothing is really going to change until the people change.
Well, that was Gerald Salente mix by Robin Carvel just out last week, really illustrating Gerald Salente. Martin, I think you come across him. He does the Trends Journal over in New York. He's one of these analysts. What do you make of him? And that was quite an interesting mix of some of his pontifications.
Well, I'm not that familiar with his work, but I mean, like a lot of critics of the system, he's a fundamentalist free marketeer, and therefore believes that banks should be allowed to go down. And I've got sympathy with that view, but I think it's naive.
So let's have a listen now to Stephen Williams MP, who was at Prime Minister's Questions this week, putting a question to David Cameron, and he is our local Bristol West Lib Dem MP.
And Mr. Stephen Williams.
Mr. Speaker, the coalition government has restored order and stability to the public finances. Yeah. Therefore, won us international confidence. Is it not now the right time in order to put renewed effort and vigour into returning growth into the economy by the government facilitating and guaranteeing investment in housing and infrastructure?
Yes. Well, I think the honourable gentleman is entirely right, and I'm sure that he welcomes the enterprise zone in Bristol and also the support for the animation and television industries. What we need to do, both in Britain and Europe, is to combine the fiscal deficit reduction, which has given us the low interest rates, with an active monetary policy, with structural reforms to make us competitive, and with innovative ways of using our hard-won credibility, which we wouldn't have if we listened to the muttering idiot sitting opposite me. Yeah.
very worried about the health of the health minister, who's so overexcited he might suffer a relapse. And I'm a compassionate chap. I don't want that to happen. But the Prime Minister will please withdraw the word idiot. It's unparliamentary. A simple withdrawal will suffice. We're grateful.
Of course, I will replace it. I will replace it with the man who left us this enormous deficit and this financial crisis.
Well, he didn't quite withdraw it, but Martin, what are your thoughts there? He was referring, when he was talking about the idiot who wasn't listening, muttering or whatever, that was Ed Balls, yeah. The Shadow Chancellor.
Well, I mean, methinks he doth protest too much. We are now in a double-dip recession, as Ed Balls correctly predicted. And Ed Balls, of course, was in charge at the end of the Labour government. And in actual fact, if people look at it objectively, they'll see that the Labour government had actually got the economy back on into growth, even though we had a banking collapse in 2008.
But isn't what Stephen Williams saying essentially correct? He's saying, well, hang on a minute, but what about growth? Well,
what's interesting with Stephen Williams as a Liberal is what he's saying is, we've done enough austerity now, it's time to take your foot off the brake and start spending. Now, you can't, in fact, as Cameron is trying to suggest, you can't have austerity and spending at the same time, because it's ultimately the ultimate fiscal stance of the government depends upon how much it's totally spending against how much it's totally taking in taxes, and that determines the boost that you're giving to the economy. You can't increase spending on one thing and then decrease it on something else and expect anything to happen. Nothing will happen. So what's happening there is that both Cameron and Stephen Williams are starting to weaken and starting to recognise that they might have to spend some money, because otherwise the economy is going to fall off a cliff. And of course, this is what Balls has been saying all along.
I mean, isn't this Gus Hoyt, you're a Green councillor here in the city in Ashley Ward, isn't this really Stephen Williams finally finding a bit of mettle here and saying to David Cameron, you know, we're doing very well and being very polite, but then he's sort of at the end of his question, he's now saying, well, what we really need is to start building housing and infrastructure.
Well, I wouldn't really. It sort of struck me really as a little bit of a duo going on there. It's quite embarrassing to listen to, especially the behaviour of all the other members. I can't believe these people are running our country, and it sort of just explains why we're in the mess we are, I think. I don't think the answer is building new houses. No, what we need to do is reinvest in the existing housing stock that is not being used at the moment. There are too many vacant landlords who are happy just to let properties sit and rot and collapse just so that they...
Are you talking about commercial properties here? Because, I mean, certainly around the city...
And homes, yes. we mustn't just build new homes. I mean, that's the classic way out of a depression, is you build new homes and you fill them full of stuff you don't need.
But I mean, you know, if you're looking at
yourself up to the next fall, then
if you're talking about empty properties, you go around the city, there's loads of office buildings, quite a lot now seem to only have anybody actually in the ground floor. If you look higher up, you'll see that upper floors are empty. So if you're just walking past, it looks as if there's activity there. I mean, you know, if you're talking about empty properties, you're talking about commercial, surely.
Well, essentially, I was talking about the 7,000 actual homes that actually exist and should be, you know, we've now got anti-squatting laws, or, you know, which will soon be enforced. I mean, we need to move these into the empty homes that are there. But yeah, as far as the commercial properties go, the empty office space, you walk around Temple Meads and, you know, you could probably fit all of the offices into one or two buildings, and there's probably about 50 or 60 of them. And yet our solution is that we open up the LEZ by Temple Meads and we get more offices being built. I mean, this is just yet again nonsense. Building for the sake of building is just, it doesn't solve
problems. Certainly doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to be building offices when we've got something like half or even possibly two-thirds of our existing offices already empty. The other point that came up at Prime Minister's questions this week was this Beecroft report, which has been put together by one of the big Tory party funders, basically suggesting that employers should be able to fire at will. This is the expression they've been using. What are your thoughts on that, Gus?
It doesn't surprise me in the slightest. It sickens me, though. The fact that, again, it's going to be the average person that is going to bear the brunt, bear the cost, bear the burden of everything that's going on. The fact that you should fire people at will, that's absolutely nonsense. I lived in the States for a while. In Colorado, that was a right-to-work state. What that meant is they could fire you at any point. And what that led to, in one of the video stores that I worked in, a lady got pregnant. Guess what happened? She got fired.
Martin, this idea of people like Mr. Beecroft, who's a Tory party funder, actually sort of drafting policy initiatives. And what about this whole idea of that, you know, fire at will?
Well, let's come back to the macroeconomics of that. What will happen if everybody realises that they can be fired at will? Are they going to go out and buy a new consumer good? Are they going to go out and spend in the high street? No, they're not. They're going to save because they can be fired at will. So it just turns the screw on the economy even further. It's economic illiteracy. It's what business people like to hear. And when I talk to business people, it's quite interesting because they know what they know about. They know about business. But when you start to talk to them about the macroeconomy, you can see that they get lost because they're not used to talking in those terms. So, if everybody gets fired or fears being fired, what you're doing is damping down demand in the economy. It's all about demand management. And, of course, what Stephen Williams was saying there earlier was hinting that the dam is about to break and people are going to realise that actually it's about putting money in people's pockets. It's not actually about building houses or even doing existing houses up. What they could do is raise wages, increase benefits. Yeah, if you're going to sack everybody, increase unemployment benefit. Don't decrease it, because if you increase unemployment benefits in those parts of the country which are going to be hit by the shock, you will cushion that shock and give them a better chance.
But that will just increase the deficit, won't it?
Not necessarily. The deficit's going to be increased anyway by the collapse of the economy. And ultimately, of course, the currency may be destroyed by all of this. But that's not... The point is, spending doesn't solve the capitalist crisis, but cutting spending doesn't solve the crisis. That's just shooting yourself in the head before the car crashes into the wall. Now, don't shoot yourself in the head. You're still in a crashing car. Now, we've still got problems to deal with, but don't shoot yourself in the head, because you really won't solve the problem that way.
OK, on to another story. And an MP has urged the EDL march be banned on Bristol's Pride Day. This is from last week. A Bristol MP has written to police and the council, urging them to scrap plans to allow a march by right-wing extremists to go ahead on the same day as the city's Pride March. The English Defence League is allegedly planning holding a march in Bristol on Saturday, July the 14th, the same day as the city's annual Pride celebrations. Gus.
Thank you, Tony. I do actually disagree with banning any kind of marching unless it really is generating hatred, which they
but,
of course.
But I mean, isn't the timing here a little bit unfortunate?
Yes, yes.
What would be your thoughts about whether the EDL should be told, well, you're going to have to march on a different day if you don't want to necessarily ban it?
Basically, with groups like the EDL, if you tell them what to do, they'll do just the opposite. What they'll do is they'll just send their frontline army in on the day, who will cause an incredible amount of damage to both people and property. What's happened is the police have been working very closely with the EDL and with Pride, and they've managed to actually negotiate that they'll do them at very different times, so that they won't all be on College Green at the same time, and hopefully the celebration, which is Pride, will not be affected.
Martin.
Well, I mean, I don't like banning things either. My policy would be, if the EDL come to Bristol, we've got to have a show of community resistance to everything they stand for, and if they bring 100 people or 200 people, we want 20,000 people to show we reject and resent their presence.
Well, what is it that you so object to about the English Defence League?
Well, the fact that they've beaten up several of my friends in recent years, that certainly accounts for me. They are I resent the word English in their title. I resent that. They don't represent anything in England that I understand I know there are people like that in England, but I think that their use of the word English in their title upsets me and angers me.
So what do you think about the sort of coincidence of dates here, this being on the same day as Pride?
They're deliberately provocative. They love provocation. I mean, we had similar problems, of course, in Northern Ireland, whether people are allowed to march or not. And ultimately, the Parades Commission was set up to decide who can march where and on what basis. And, of course, the English Defence League could march somewhere completely different from Bristol and not cause a problem. Like the Loyalists can march in their own community. It's when they try to march down the Gavachie Road, which is actually a nationalist area, that the trouble starts, because they don't want them. Now, ultimately, there is no absolute right to demonstrate. There isn't one. Not in
so
Northern
do you
Ireland
agree then
here.
With Kerry McCarthy, who's mentioned in this article here, saying that they should not be allowed to march at all on that day?
I don't necessarily agree with Kerry. I think if they want to come to Bristol, they better be prepared to face opposition. That's all I'll say.
Okay, the old cabinet system is now scrapped. That is, we're talking about South Gloucestershire here. The return to the rule by the old-style committees will go ahead now at South Gloucestershire after members have officially now scrapped the cabinet system. Labour councillors has called for committees to make a comeback instead of leaving most of the decision making in the hands of just seven councillors. Now, this is really talking about some of the sort of mystical machinations of decision making in local authorities, Gus. What are your thoughts about they've gone back to the old committee system, they've scrapped the cabinet?
Yeah, I'd say that neither the committee system nor the cabinet system's perfect by a long shot. I think we need a lot more governance in the communities that we live in. However, during the mayoral campaign, we were saying that basically the direction we maybe should be looking at in Bristol is going back to the cabinet system and not centralising it, not just on the seven people as we have at the moment, or they have at the moment, but on the one person, which is the mayor.
So we're going in the opposite direction to South Gloucestershire's going in this sort of
much more
grassroots direction in a way where the decision making is spread out amongst all the elected councillors. In Bristol we're going the opposite direction,
and
aren't
and
we?
You also know then who's accountable for taking what decisions, whereas at the moment it all happens behind closed doors.
Martin.
I think that's right. I mean, they talk about localism and local innovation, and the Labour and Liberal parties in South Gloucestershire have decided we're not interested in your centralised policy at all. We're going back to the way we used to run things. And of course, this is the way local authorities used to be running this country for donkey's years, for years and years and years and years and years and years and years. And what I would say to those of a conservative disposition is, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Why do you think we had a system like that running for years and years and years? Because in actual fact, it was the best system.
Well, many people are saying, Martin,
not the very best, but just the best
Martin,
possible.
Martin, many people are saying that the system is broke. It's way too bureaucratic the way it is.
No. When they talk about way too bureaucratic, what we've got is developers who would like to crash, bang, wallop and push stuff through in Bristol. And of course, when the green spaces thing came through and they wanted to close down all the various green spaces in Bristol, the local communities went up in arms. Now, just imagine if Gary Hopkins had been mayor and he'd be able to say, steamroller. That's the rest of the, I've got 4 years and it doesn't matter what you want, I'm gonna build on these. That's what they mean when they say about bureaucratic. Because of course democracy is bureaucratic. It's not bureaucratic, it's time consuming, because you can't just run railroad things through. You've got to discuss it with people, you've got to create consensus. And in actual fact, that is democracy, not bureaucracy. And of course, what we're trying to do is centralise power in the hands of individuals or cabinets, and then of course they can be got at by the powerful and be behind closed doors, as you quite likely pointed out, and then and stuff can go through. Boris Johnson has met the people from the City of London, bankers and all the rest of it, far more times than he's met the police force as he's been Mayor of London. Says everything.
Yeah, and also something that we have to think about too is speeding up the process is just definitely not the right way to go. If we did that in the past, we'd have concreted over Cumberland Basin, we'd have a motorway going right through the middle of Ashley up into Clifton, and we all know what would have happened with the stadium on Ashton Vale. And I don't think Gary's going for mayor. I think he's going for police commissioner.
Yes, okay.
Right, interesting. Architect George Ferguson has emerged as the early favourite to become Bristol's first elected mayor. He's quoted by Ladbrokes. This is in last Saturday's Post, which I thought was actually supposed to be a five-day paper, but apparently seems to be coming out on Saturdays too. I'm complaining. He's quoted by Ladbrokes at 2-1, while former Labour councillor Kelvin Blake is his nearest rival at 5-1. Mr Ferguson is standing as an independent, though he used to be a Liberal Democrat councillor, and launched his election campaign at a meeting earlier this week, said it's slightly disappointing. I was hoping for longer odds at this stage. It's hardly worth putting on a bet. Gus.
Well, what we've got to realise here is that George actually is the only candidate that's come out yet. We don't know who's going to run. We don't know.
But we do know that
Labour have five. We don't know who Liberals running.
Paulette North is definitely a councillor.
And we've got the, I don't think I could probably pronounce his name on the radio station, but the protest guy as well. And then the Green candidate as well. I think we'll get to see a lot more realistic odds once we know who actually
but,
is.
But George Ferguson is very much backed by the business community, friends in the business community, things like Business West.
We haven't seen the Conservative.
And also, of course, he's a merchant venturer, which I mention on it as many times as I can because the Evening Post don't seem to know. Martin, how do you think he's panning out as a candidate, George?
Well, I mean, I think because he's an ex-Liberal Democrat, people have a fairly good idea of his politics, which are centrist in a Liberal Democrat sort of way. But, of course, if he isn't going to stand for the Liberal Democrats, then the Liberal Democrats will stand against him. And that's going to count against him. He's going to lose some votes to Liberal voters.
It almost seems like a done deal, you know. He's already, they've been talking about him in the, certainly in the Evening Post, when it was the Evening Post, for about 8 or 10 years as a possible mayor. Now he's way ahead of everybody else. It doesn't seem like there's going to be much of a competition because, I mean, everybody is slightly disillusioned with party politics, and he seems to be the guy to vote for if you are.
Yeah, apart from the fact that he's an ex-Liberal, so we all know that he is a party politician, even though he pretends he isn't, you know. I mean, at the end of the day, he will have to justify himself to a much wider electorate than he's used to talking to. And I think once Labour have selected their candidate, we'll have to select the correct candidate, in my view. I haven't made my mind up yet. But I think come the November, after the banking collapse and all the rest of it that I've been talking about, Labour will be ahead in the opinion polls, I imagine. And loyalty will lead people to recognise that they need to vote for people who can get stuff done locally and nationally. And it won't be an election for mavericks, outsiders and hopeless idealists, which is how I think George is, basically.
I think actually it's going to be a case of basically slap a red rosette on a donkey and they'll probably get elected in this one. It's why the two major parties generally are in favour of mayoral elections, is because it does force it down just to Conservative and Labour, because that's what everyone knows. I wonder how many people in Knowle know who George Ferguson is, really.
Well, he's been...
There's a lot of people in Clifton know who he is, but then Clifton doesn't decide the election.
Anybody over the last couple of months that's seen a copy of the Post probably knows who he is.
Don't you imagine that everybody reads everything in the Post, Tony? Not everybody is as sad as you.
All right, or on the BBC, then. Maybe they don't watch that either. On to our next story. And now we have BBC Radio Bristol's audience is down by 25%. You couldn't make it up, but... this is in the Post on last Friday. Radio Bristol's lost a quarter of its listeners in a year, according to the latest industry figures. Meanwhile, commercial radio stations Jack FM and Heart have enjoyed an increase in the industry analyst Rajar figures. Unfortunately, BCFM doesn't feature on these because we don't pay to have our figures registered. Gus, what do you think's behind this pretty appalling slide in audience figures for Radio Bristol? Any ideas?
It's kind of hard to predict, really. I mean, there are just so many radio stations out there at the moment, and of course the internet's quite a big game nowadays. I think really there's just so much choice out there now that people, rather than go for one sort of overview, they like to go for their specific interests, whether it's a station that focuses just on reggae music or just on politics.
Well, if we want my two halfpence, it's because they don't really do hardly anything which is proactive journalism. They're not going out there finding stuff. They're waiting for stuff to sort of turn up as an email press release or whatever. They don't seem to have very much in the way of an adventurous spirit to go out and sort of do anything new. Martin, we had a discussion, I think it was last October when the last figures were out, where the previous year they'd lost 50% of their audience. So the last 6 months ago, they lost 50%. Now they've lost 25% on top of that. They're not going to have a lot left, are they?
Well, I think it's sad in a way, because BBC, local BBC, is public interest journalism. And, you know, the people aren't listening. It's, you know, let's not be sitting here crowing about failure on other radio stations, you know. I mean, we all try to be colleagues in this city in a constructive fashion.
I mean, for example, John Darbell in the mornings, I was listening a few weeks ago, he interviewed Liam Fox for about 20 minutes, 25 minutes, and didn't even mention anything to do with the fact that he'd been removed from office. It was a sort of nice, friendly, little chatty interview. The fact that he's...
I think one of the things... I mean, what we're able to do on community radio here, Tony...
BBC. It doesn't have to be community radio to ask awkward questions.
They interpret their brief as being not to be too controversial, not to rock the boat. And, of course, it doesn't make very interesting
radio. When we've had a local MP who was Defence Secretary, who's been sacked because it looks like he's corrupt. He's going around with some guy, Adam Werity, who is working for some charity who's got no kind of security clearance, and he's going around meetings all around the world with this guy, and so he's sacked because it looks like there's something corrupt going on. How can you just not even mention it, pretend it doesn't exist?
Well, I mean, as we know, Paxman and so on has got to have a reputation for being bulldogish, but local radio, BBC Radio, doesn't. And I'm afraid that they perhaps need to be more bulldogish. But of course, if they were to put the boot into ex-ministers like Liam Fox, they then got a situation where they may lose their licence or their licence fee be...
I'll tell you what might actually more realistically happen is that they wouldn't get another interview with Liam Fox.
Yes.
That's more like it. That's the way these things work. But anyway, I was... My two habits, I suppose I've had it, my little soapbox, is look, you know, go out and find the stories. Don't just wait for them to roll through the door. And also, be a bit adventurous, Radio Bristol. Because like you say, we do want them to do well. They are the public service broadcasters of the city. So anyway, let's hope that they get some of their audience back by the time for the next figures are out. Our next story, A4E, Welfare to Work Fraud Scandal. The Welfare to Work firm owned by David Cameron's former family's Tsar is involved in a multi-billion scandal which public money has been systematically misused. And this is evidence from a chap called Mr. Hutchinson, who was one of their auditors, has come out publicly and said that the whole company was set up basically to facilitate fraud.
Well, yes, and this is what I mean. And of course, the woman who runs it, Emma, whatever her name is,
Harrison.
Emma Harrison
used to. She's now left.
But I mean, she was being paid. She's been made a millionaire as a result of setting up this company, whose main customer is the government, i.e., the taxpayer. And of course, her salary every year makes her top civil servant salary look like a pittance. But of course, nobody questions that. Every penny that A4E makes is from the taxpayer. But because they're private sector, they're allowed to charge what they like. They take the idea that all they've got to do is tick the boxes and take the money, and their top executives are paid far higher than civil servants. This is called saving money. So, except it isn't saving anybody any money. What it is those who are well placed, and of course Emma Harrison was very close to the Conservative Party, they get looked after. And that's what happens in this country. It's what happens in lots of countries. It's called crony capitalism.
Yeah, and she's still got her mansion, apparently, up north. Gus, what's the Green Party's policy with regard to, getting people back into work and benefits, this kind of thing?
It's actually quite an extreme shake-up of the whole system. Basically, you start with the citizens' income instead of welfare. So actually, every single person over the age of 16 is paid a set amount of money. This actually ends up being a lot cheaper, by the way, than the current benefits system. You'd also have a living wage, not just a minimum wage, because what use is a minimum wage? You need a wage you can live on.
Which would have to be higher than your citizens' income.
It would be, yeah.
Well, actually, although if you've got a citizens' income, you can have people working the flexible way, can't you?
That actually leads on to my next point. Okay. I'd say, and this isn't official Green Party policy, but I'm a great fan of the NEF, which is the New Economics Foundation, their report on the 21-hour week, where basically no one would have to work more than 21 hours because that would meet everyone's basic needs.
How can you run a country if everyone's only working 21 hours a week?
There'll be a lot more people in employment then, because you just wouldn't have one person working a ton of overtime. You'd actually have two or three people working that job. Everyone would be happy. Everyone would be.
Sounds like families might even have the time for a bit of childcare, for example.
And people would start talking to each other again. Yeah,
Martin, is it a viable policy? This?
Absolutely. And we, as Gus was saying earlier on, what we need to do. This crisis is going to be really horrible. It's going to be far more horrible than most comfortable people really imagine. But the only positive feature of it is we should make demands for what we really want. We need a vision for the future society we want our children and our grandchildren to live in. That's the kind of society I want my grandchildren to live in, not one where they are either at the bottom of the pile, being pushed around from care to prison, or at the top of the pile stealing and getting away with it like Emma Harrison. We want a different kind of society where everybody contributes and everybody's looked after.
Because
not in everybody completely equal, that would be silly, but everybody with an equal concern for their welfare. I wouldn't even say equal opportunity, equal concern for everybody's welfare.
And not just treated as a commodity.
Okay, well, that's a nice way to finish. That's all for now. That was Gus Hoyt, the Ashley Ward Green Party councillor. Time now for the Sky News at 6. After the news, the feudal lords are still alive and well and doing very nicely, thank you.
Listen live online at bcfm.org.uk. BCFM News.